Good. Okay, so I have to do several disclaimers before I start. The first one, I know nothing about schizophrenia, so I'm in a learning mode here, and as Francis said, they had a goal of putting people out of their comfort zone, so I'm there, and so I'm learning. And the reason I'm here is because I was asked to give a tutorial talk on this class of models, on this modeling tool, mean field models. Another thing that I, and so this is going to be a tutorial type talk, so those of you who are computational people out there and know all about those, you know, feel free to review or read your email for now. But if you're a newcomer, a student, you know, feel free to ask questions. This should be accessible, and it won't be heavy on math, so hopefully you can learn from it. And the other thing I want to say is that there's some people in the audience, Bart in particular, whose name is going to appear on the slides a lot because he really is the expert in this particular area. And so if you're interested in the topic, you know, you should use the opportunity to ask questions of the real experts here. Okay, just to put you out of your comfort zone for a second. So that's the plan. So to introduce myself, I'm Albert Sieck. I'm a professor at the University of Utah in the math and in the program for neuroscience. I'm a computational neuroscientist. Okay, so what are we talking about? So mean field models. As I started preparing this and, you know, looking at various things, I realized that actually different people mean different things when they say mean field models. So, you know, if you read different sources, then you will encounter kind of different models called by that name. But really, I think everybody agrees that in general, this field builds on this classical work by Wilson and Cobham and Amari. And there's a huge, you know, since that time, there has been huge literature in the field of mean field models and many different variations and many different applications, a lot of mathematical theory developed. And I'm going to show you some examples of what people did theoretically and also some applications. But I want to warn you that this is, you know, tip of the iceberg, that, you know, I'm just going to mention a few select examples. There's large literature out there. And I just put in here several recent reviews that you know, thoroughly go through, you know, many applications and many theoretical results as well. So if your favorite example or, you know, your specific model is not in my talk, I apologize, but really I'm just giving a few examples. Okay, so what are we talking about? What are, kind of in general, what are mean field models and why we may want to use them? Okay, so what we should be thinking about is we have a very large network of neurons. Okay, very large, I mean, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of neurons. And so there are too many to model each one individually. So we've heard talks about, you know, many different specific types of neurons with many specific currents. So this is a situation where you can't afford to model each neuron individually with so many currents. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is you do have a spiking network model, but then you want to tune it into a particular dynamic regime, or you're wondering whether it can support a particular dynamic regime, and I will give examples of that. And you need to tune it there, but you have too many parameters to tune. So you may want to use a mean field approximation to your spiking model as a tool to tune your spiking model into a particular regime or see if it has a particular regime. Okay, so you have a large network of neurons. And for your purposes, for the purposes of whatever problem you're thinking about at the moment, it's enough to consider mean network activity and mean synaptic activity levels of the population. Okay, so let's just consider simplest case. We have one population of neurons, one type of neurons. I'll call them E. These are, let's say, excitatory cells. There are many, many cells. There's one population of them. And so we're going to think at the moment that it's enough to describe the dynamics of this population, the behavior of this population. It's enough to keep track of this variable E of T, which is going to be a loosely defined mean activity level of the population. Okay, I'll say more about it in a second. So this is the mean activity level. So that's going to describe this whole population, this one variable. And then if the cells are connected to each other, for example, approximately all connected, then you can say that this network is connected to this one variable is connected by to itself. Okay, so each cell is connected to other cells in the network. We're going to represent it this way. And maybe it's also getting external input from somewhere else. Okay, so that's the simplest situation that we're thinking about. So several notes. The activity is allowed to vary in time. That's why I wrote E of T here. But it's averaged over the network. So it's not averaged over time. It's allowed to vary with time, but it's average activity of the network. Okay, so for some, so we're assuming the network is homogeneous. They're all the same kind of cells. And for some technical reasons, you need a synchronous spike level activity. So at the level of single spikes, they are not all firing at the same time. And one way to achieve that is to have connections that are slow relative to membrane dynamics that will prevent the cells from synchronizing. Okay, so many times people have derived this kind of mean field models that I'm going to write in a second. They attempted to derive them from first principles, meaning taking networks of spiking cells and then average over the population and derive this mean field description. But different people make different assumptions in the process, and so there's no agreement between people of how, you know, what model is the right model and how to go from spiking models to the mean field model. So in some sense, these are ad hoc. We just have some considerations for how to write them. Okay, so the partially because there's no this rigorous derivation, this activity variable that I called E can mean different things in different people's interpretation, and the equations are going to be a little bit different depending on that. So that activity level can mean firing rate, so mean firing rate. It can mean membrane potential, or it can mean synaptic activity. So depending on your interpretation, and I will use it somewhat loosely most of the time. Okay, so let's pretend for a second like that E is synaptic activity, is representative of synaptic activity of cells. Then we're going to write an equation for this. Okay, so we're going to say that E. So forget that for a second. Let's pretend this term is zero. This has something to do with the input, so let's pretend that's zero. So E dot is equal to minus E dot is the time derivative. So time derivative of E is equal to minus E with some time constant. So in the absence of input, if that input term is zero, E just wants to go to zero, just relax to no activity. So that's fine. Now, if we are, if we do have this term, then what is E going to do? And those of you who were in the tutorials, this should sound, this next part should sound familiar, is that we will figure out what E is going to do by considering steady states of this equation. And the steady states of this equation is when derivative is equal to zero, or the right-hand side is equal to zero, so when E is equal to F of input. So that gives us a clue to what F should be. If you get in some input, then you will get the output activity E. So what F is really the input-output function of the population. And notice that it's not the FI curve of an individual cell. This is averaged over the population. Okay, so that's the population input-output function. In principle, it can be measured experimentally or approximated from experiments. A lot of times, though, people just take kind of an arbitrary function. Usually, it's a sigmoidal type function, and I'm going to use that in a second. So now let's talk about what, so this is F of input. So now let's look what input to the system is. And we can see from the picture there are two parts, the input from the population itself and then the external input. So we can write that the input from the population itself is proportional to the population activity. Remember, this is synaptic activity right now. It's just proportional to that. And then plus the external input. So this is F of the total input. So now, what are the steady states of the system? Now, the steady states of the system are determined again by setting right-hand side equal to zero, determined by this equation. In other words, when F as a function of E intersects with the E. Okay, so what we can do, and since this is a tutorial, I'm going to write on the board. So what we can do is we can put E here, and we can draw that E curve, which is just a straight line. And then we can draw the F of E, which is written there. And then for small connectivity, it's going to look something like this. So usually F is taken to be a sigmoidal function, I said, and sigmoidal function looks something like this. And for small w, it's going to look like this. So there's going to be one steady state and for low E steady state, and it's going to be stable. And so what that means is that if you plot E versus time, you're going to start at some level of activity. The network is going to settle to some low constant activity level. Now, if you make WE, so for small e, settle at some activity level. If we make W larger, what's going to happen is now we're going to have three steady states of the system, and the middle one is going to be unstable, but these two are going to be stable. So what that's going to mean is that now E is a function of time. Let's say we were sitting somewhere, and depending, so if we provide a short stimulus that will either kick it up or kick it down, then it will go to either one steady state or the other steady state, depending on where you kicked it. And so in some sense, even this very, very simple model already can be interpreted as having some meaning as a memory device. So you provide a very brief stimulus, but then depending on what that stimulus was, it will go to either one steady state, and remember that the stimulus did kick it up, or if the stimulus kicked it down, it will stay there even in the absence of stimulus. So this is, you know, one bit of information that this device can remember. Okay, so now I told you that there are different interpretations that E can have, and I want to mention another one because it's going to be useful. So if you interpret E as a kind of membrane potential, then what you need to do is you need to convert the membrane potential to synaptic current. And the way to do it, one way to do it, is again to go through the function F, which in this case is a transformation from voltage to synaptic current. So if E has some membrane potential, then the synaptic current that it's going to provide to itself is proportional to F of E. And in both cases, so you can see that the subtle difference is that F now applies not to the whole input, but to individual components of the input. Yeah.
So by membrane potential, you mean like the average membrane?
The average membrane potential, exactly. That's exactly what I mean. Okay, so in either case, in the synaptic activity or in average membrane potential, F of X is often taken to be the sigmoidal function, but also very often, especially when people want to do analytical solutions, then they use Heaviside function as an approximation of sigmoid, you know, extra infinitely fast changing sigmoid functions because it makes analytics easier. And sort of for the same reason, sometimes they use piecewise linear function as an approximation of the slower part of sigmoid. Okay. So now, so this is the simplest version of the mean field model. Now you can make many extensions. So one obvious extension is to have multiple networks. And in this case, I'm just using two networks, but you can also, you know, do as many as you like. And these are, this can be subpopulations in your, in that brain area that you're considering. These different networks could be subpopulations of different classes of neurons. Okay, so in this case, we have E and I networks, and I think I don't have equation there. So you can write an equation of very similar type, tau E, E dot is equal to, and it depends how you interpret E exactly what equation you want to write. For example, you can write the equation minus E plus W E E F, oops, F of E plus W E I F of I plus the external input, and you can write the same type of equation for I. And of course, this function F can also have a subscript if they have, if your different populations have different input-output properties. Okay, so simple to generalize. So this is a system of two ODEs now, and you can use all phase plane methods that you guys learned in tutorials, some of you. And you can find that, for example, as you change some parameters in this network, you can one of the things that you can get is oscillations, where each of the populations will have its activity go up and down with time. Where each population will have its activity go up and down with time, and they will kind of alternate between populations. Okay, so that's one possible extension. I will just mention that it is possible there, it, in the literature, in those review chapters that I referred to, you can look how to include many different features. If they're important in the system, they can be incorporated in this kind of model. In particular, you can incorporate axonal delays, different kinds of adaptations, synaptic adaptation or intrinsic adaptation, and you can distinguish between them. You can include synaptic and dendritic filtering. You can also include noise and spatial structure, and these are the last two things that I'm going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about these other things, but they can be included, and in this has been used in sound fiction. Okay, so let's talk about noise. Noise has become very ubiquitous. People talk about it in many different contexts, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is because there are more experiments now that are being done in vivo than there used to be, and in vivo situations as opposed to in vitro situations, noise is much more important. There's much more noise activity. The other reason is that theoretical methods, mathematical methods, are now more sophisticated and are we're being able to consider stochastic and noisy systems much better than we were able to do it before. So in many different contexts, it has been shown that noise doesn't just disrupt the dynamics that you had, but it can actually create new features of the network dynamics. So I think this is very important to know about noise, is that it doesn't just disrupt things, it creates things as well. And I'll just show you one example of mean field model where this has been the case. In this case, we considered a network of cells. They're all to all connected, and we considered the network in the context of control of breathing, but it's a very general system. So they're all to all connected. Individual neurons have some form of adaptation in them, and then they're all receiving noisy external input that you can think of as on specific input from other brain areas. Okay, so individual cells are not bursters. Some of them are silent, and some of them maybe are spiking. But when you hook them all up together and you have those external inputs, then population has this bursting regime. And I think a solid curve is a spiking model, and then the dashed one is a mean field model. So what I want to emphasize here, the first thing I want to say is that this is an example of the two contexts in which I said the mean field models can be useful. So first of all, the mean field model, mean field description, allows us to tune this spiking model into this regime. And the other reason that it's useful is that because the mean field model is much reduced, has many fewer degrees of freedom, many fewer equations, we're able to analyze it in terms of bifurcations. I'm not going to go into details of this, but the point is we can draw bifurcation structures for it. We can understand what are the mechanisms that drive the dynamics that we see in both the mean field and the spiking model. Okay, so but we're talking about noise. So here's this population response in both models, and what's varied from plot to plot is the level of noise, is the sigma of noise, the amplitude of noise. Okay, and you can see that when you were varying it, as we go down, what changes in particular is the frequency of the population oscillations. So one of the ways to control the frequency of population oscillations is to vary the amount of noise, of external noise, that the system is receiving. And I told you, yes?
Good question. Yes, yeah. So this result, numerical result, they are for mean-field model or for the
There are two curves in each graph, and the solid line is a spiking model, is a network model, and the dashed line is the mean-field model. Okay, so one is approximating the other. So my point here, so remember I was going to tell you that noise creates something. So here is a plot where the darkness of a cell means the population rate, the bursting rate of the network. And if there's no noise, then we can vary the minimal frequency that you can achieve and maximal frequency that you can achieve have some range. But if you do vary noise as well, which is the vertical axis here, that's the amplitude of the noise, you can cover much larger range of frequencies with which your network can burst. And this is important, like I said, in our case it was important because it was in terms of, because it was in the context of breathing control where you do need to vary over a large range of frequencies. But in general, my point is that this is one of the features that's created by noise. So it's important to include noise in all kinds of models, including mean field models. Yes?
I think I noticed this. What is the effect of noise on the mean field? Is it the
load
of the signal?
I actually didn't say that. I can show you equations. I didn't want to overload the talk with the equations. So in the network, what it is, it's the external input that it's receiving. That's the sigma of that external input, the amplitude of the external input noise that it's getting. So it's getting many little brief pulses, and if you look at all of them, it's essentially that, and it's the sigma of that, the amplitude of that signal that we're varying. That's a good question. Well, in any case, we don't expect a precise correspondence between one and the other because mean field is an approximation. And I actually don't remember why there's that specific relationship between them, and I'm not sure that I even know. But, in general, it predicts the frequency pretty well, but not right on. Okay, so again, my point was noise can be important to include in this model. Okay, so the other very important aspect, and this is a whole different industry, and some people don't call these mean field models, and some people do, is adding spatial structure to the system. So think about, large network that has some spatial structure. In this particular example, this is a picture of orientation selectivity in primary visual cortex. So this is V1, primary visual cortex, unwrapped into a single layer, and or flat surface, and different colors correspond to orientation preference of the cells. So cells in the V1 primarily like the bars that are oriented in a particular direction. So cells are colored based on which orientation of bars they like to respond to. And obviously it has some spatial structure, and there are places like this, which are called pinwheels, where their orientation preference kind of changes smoothly around them. And then there are the stripes in between the pinwheels where the orientation preference is kind of constant. The point is there is very specific spatial structure. And let's just for a second pretend like we only care about excitatory neurons in this network. So all neurons are of the same kind, of the same class, so that we can use, you know, one population of cells. Okay, so one way to look at this is to locally to break this whole surface into little cell into little clusters or cells, where you're going to say that you're going to identify a subpopulation of neurons in that region into your little population. Okay, so for example, near the pinwheel, you can say that all cells that have similar orientation preference, all red cells are going to be one population, all yellow cells are going to be another population, etc. Then what you're doing, you have many cells, and locally you're saying this is going to be one population, this is going to be another population. So essentially what you're doing, you're saying that you're going to now talk about activity, and I will change my notation here and write U for activity, which is very common in this field. You're going to say that this is a subpopulation in location X, okay, and then you're still allowing it to vary with time. So now this is the quantity that you will consider, and again, this is activity of your little population varying with time, but now your little population is indexed by where it's located. Okay, so now how can you write an equation for this? Well, let's see what I have here. Right, so you're going to define activity variable for each of the cells at location X, and then what you can do, you can write an equation for this. Let me write one here first. So du, dt, and you can write some tau here. The reason I'm writing partial derivatives is because technically it's now a function of two variables, but it's still just time derivatives. Nothing has changed. So it's minus u, just like we had before. And then what we have to add, just like we had here, we have to add the connectivity. And now we have to add connectivity between population at X, which is the one that we're writing an equation for, and a different location Y. So all these guys will be set to be connected. And then times F of that other population, plus maybe the external input, I external. Okay, so if you compare to this, this is essentially the same thing, and now we have to sum this over all values of y. So for each population that it's getting input from, we're taking f of activity of that population, multiplied by the weight, and then add them up. And that's exactly what I'm doing here. Okay, exactly the same. Okay, so now what we're going to do, we're going to say, okay, so we have this really large layer of neurons. There are many, many different cells, right, that we identify, many different subpopulations everywhere. So now if we look from far away, and if there are many of those populations in our network, then what we can do, instead of taking these discrete values of y, we can say we're stepping back and we're taking a continuum limit. We're going to say that these cells are everywhere. These y's cover everything. Then we still have the same equation, but now what we will have to do, instead of the sum here, we're going to have to take an integral, and this w of xy is still the same, Now this is dy, and then possibly some external input. Okay, so this is an integer differential equation. Okay, so fairly complicated object. Mathematicians love it, partially because they can do analysis using mostly adapting the methods of PDEs that people have developed in that field, can be adapted to study this equation. Okay, so what are different components here? F is the same F as we talked about, sigmoid function or Heaviside function or threshold linear function. And this W is connectivity, is the input, the strength of input that cell X gets from cell Y. What are the forms of that connectivity? The most typical thing that people very often use is they take W to be a function of distance between X and Y, and the most typical form of that function is this bell-shaped thing. Basically, this is saying that the cell is going to get strong inputs from cells that are near it, and then as the distance between cells goes away, the connections become weaker. Okay, now in some situations, this is not enough, and you have to do something more special for the connectivity. So here is again an example of the same V1 picture. By the way, this is experimental pictures. So this is another example of the same orientation selectivity, different colors. But what they also did here, they injected something, some dye, in one of the cells that have this preference for blue, for near 90 degrees orientation, and they traced where that neuron connects to. And you can see there are these patches of dark dots that are preferentially, so nearby, this kind of connects to everybody regardless of the color, but then far away, they show up preferentially at the blue. So at the cells that have the same orientation preference as the original cell. So if we want to model this network in detail, then we would have to use the connectivity function that has two components. It has this local isotropic component that's kind of like this bell-shaped function perhaps, but it also has this long-range anisotropic component which the strength of that connection depends on the orientation preference of the cells, not just on the physical location, but on the orientation preference of the cells. Okay, so this has been done several papers by my colleague Paul Resloff, where this kind of connectivity was included to account for this surface experimental data. Okay, the other extension of this that we again need is to include different types of networks, in particular excitatory inhibitory networks. And even in the V1 example, we of course know that there are in each location there are both excitatory and inhibitory cells. So one way to include this is to say that instead of that one layer, we really have two layers, and the cells that are, you know, right above each other, they're really physically in the same location, but we're going to think of them as two separate layers. So we're going to have equations like this for cells in each layer, in the E layer and in the I layer, and then the connectivity is going to have, again, components that are inside the layer, but also in between layers. So that's a way to include both. Sometimes people do a simplification. Let's say that we're looking at the cell at the E layer here, this cell, and it receives inputs from nearby cells that are excitatory, but it also receives input from the cells in the inhibitory layer. And let's say these are wider than this. This distribution is wider than that. Then sometimes what people do, they collapse the two layers together. They will only consider one layer of cells, and connectivity is going to be the effective connectivity. Okay, so we're going to say the cell is receiving excitatory input from the cells that are nearby, and it's getting inhibitory input from the cells that are further away. So this is not really true. One cell doesn't send both excitatory and inhibitory inputs usually to its neighbors, but as an effective input of what cell is seeing, this is not a bad approximation. It allows you to collapse your system to one layer instead of two. Okay, so far we've talked about different modifications, different things that can be included in this model. But once you have the model, what can you study with it? What kinds of things have been studied? And like I said, these are going to be very much examples. There are many more things out there. Yeah. Right. So this is going to be one of those E or I populations. The other one is going to have exactly the same equation with a different index. So we're going to write U E. But then we also need another integral here that's going to integrate over the I population. It's going to get an extra input from the I population. That's right. Any more questions? Okay. So let's go to examples. So one thing that people have studied quite a bit with this kind of models is wave propagation. So mathematically, what is wave propagation in general? So you're imagining that you have, let's say, one-dimensional piece of tissue. Or, in this particular case, this is an experimental example where you have an array of electrodes in layer 2-3 of somatosensory cortex, I believe. So this is a one-dimensional array of electrodes. And so if you're looking at a particular moment of time, this is not one to hold up. If you're looking at a particular moment in time, then you will see activity is elevated in some part of this array and then, quite low in the other parts of this array. And this is what's shown in one of these graphs here on top. The activity is lower here and then goes up and then goes down again across this. That's not really what is shown here, but we can think of it that way. And then as the time goes on, what's going to happen is this activity profile is going to propagate. So if you look at the later time, you're going to see exactly the same activity profile, except it's going to be located in a different place. And so with time, it just smoothly moves along the space without changing the shape. That's what we mean when we're talking about wave propagation. Mathematically, the way it's studied in this kind of models is that you assume that you have a solution of that form that has a specific shape and that can move without changing its shape with time. You plug this solution, you assume it, you plug it into the equation, and then you find conditions on your equation when that solution can indeed be supported. This is a standard technique from traveling waves in PDEs. So this is an example where this one of the examples where this wave propagation was studied was in disinhibited cortical slices by David Pinto and Bart Ehrmantraut. And so this is a later example also from David Pinto, where they see the wave propagating in the cortical slice. And so one of the things that you can do in the model is to ask that wave speed, how fast your wave is propagating, how that is dependent on underlying connectivity. What happens if you block inhibition to some extent, reduce the level of inhibition, what that is going to do to the speed of wave propagation. Another example, which is a very different example of wave propagation, is from binocular rivalry. So here is a psychophysical experiment where the left eye is looking at the grating like this, and the right eye is looking at the very faint version of it. You can barely see it probably from where you are. And then what happens is if there's a flash in one location, then the percept will be that there is a wave moving around this circle the wave of this stained grading kind of erasing the bright grading. And so for a while you won't see any bright grading at all because it's been erased by this wave. And so people have recorded in somewhere in, or in V1, I believe, somewhere in the cortex, and they actually see waves of activity going through the cortex. So these are two signals at different, that peak at different times into different locations. So these are two different locations where they recorded, and they can see this two different locations, and they can see the activity is similar, but peaks at different times. So there's a recent model that used the mean field equations. So they have two one-dimensional fields that are connected with cross inhibition and recurrent excitation within layer. And one of the things, and so what they want to see is they want to see a wave propagating in one of these, and then as it's disappearing in one of these layers, it will appear in the other layer. So that's the representation of one, the percept of one eye dominating over the other eye. So it will switch from one eye to the other. And again, you can look at how important is the cross inhibition or the adaptation within layer, and you can predict how fast this change of perception is going to happen and all those different things in this model. Okay, so I'm going to skip that. So one last example that I'm going to talk about is Bard's work, just to wake you up. And so in a long time ago now, there was work, experimental work that surveyed hallucinations in many people, and the geometric hallucinations, and people reported that, you know, they practically all fell into these four different classes, and this is, you know, how they drew them. Now, originally by Bart was Jack Cobbin, they did a model of V1 of primary visual cortex, and the question was, if the network originally sits in this kind of everybody the same low activity state, but then you perturb it in some way, then it may settle to some new state that's not necessarily uniform, okay, that may be more interesting. Some parts of the system will be more activated than others. And it turns out that the network can support these different states depending on the parameters of the network or the parameters of the perturbation. It can settle into one of these different states with, you know, stripes or rectangular grid or hexagonal grid. And so that's what the activity in the cortex would look like. Some spots would be, you know, more active, this is light, and some spots would be less active, this is dark. So, but the interesting thing now is that if this is the activity in the cortex, what visual percept would it correspond to? Okay, what would make that picture in the cortex? Well, it turns out that there is a very clear map between what happens on your retina, what you're actually seeing, and what kind of activity you see in the cortex. So if you map this back from, you know, that activity in the cortex to what retina would have seen, so how, you know, higher areas of the brain presumably would interpret these patterns of activity in V1, then these are the pictures that you would get in the retinal coordinates, or, you know, what your brain would see when your V1 is activated, and they're very, very similar to these universal patterns that, you know, everybody seems to report when they're, after they've eaten the peyote cactus. And that's what literally, this is the data, that's how it was collected. Okay, so they're very, very similar. So there's something very appealing there, you know, some details that are, you know, take this with a bit of caution, but in general, this is very, very appealing in that you can predict where these patterns come from. Now, this last picture, I got from Bard's website, and I have no idea what it, how it fits into the story, but it says this is hallucination, so let me just finish, and then you can comment on this if you want. Okay, so basically the conclusion is that the mean field description is appropriate for large networks in those cases when tracking only mean quantities is sufficient. There are work at the forefront of this where people try to generalize this when you don't just check mean quantities but actually distribution of quantities. Much more complicated, you know, well beyond what I was going to cover, and this is, you know, forefront of research. There are many people working on this, doing really good work. Another point that I was trying to make is that many realistic features, such as adaptation and anisotropic connections, can be included in this, and this approach has been productive in many applications. So if you think, you know, your favorite system that you're thinking about may fall into this description, this may be a really good tool to look at least that could allow you to calibrate your spiking model and to tell you which dynamic regimes it can and cannot support. Okay, thank you. Bart, do you want to tell us what this is? Oh, yeah, that's a good question first. Yeah, go ahead. How to keep track of phase relationship? You can't. If you think your network breaks up into several classes where, let's say, you know, excitatory and inhibitory neurons in some particular regime, inhibitory neurons will lag excitatory ones by a quarter of a period or something like that, then you can put you can treat the excitatory neurons as one class and inhibitory neurons as the other class and see their rates being shifted by a quarter of a period. But you can't do it. It's just not an appropriate framework if you want to keep phase relationships between individual cells, and you know that phase relationship may change and things like that. Yeah. So population density methods are generalization of this that doesn't just keep track of the mean quantity, but it keeps track of the distribution of things. So that still doesn't keep track of the phase of individual cells, but at least it can tell you that cells are, you know, distribution of phases is, you know, wider in some regime, which means they're more desynchronized or, you know, more narrow in some regime. But if you're really interested in the phase of individual neurons, that's what you have to look at. Density models would be intermediate between this and that. More questions? Yeah. Yeah, you can. In that example, we actually had a derivation of the mean field model from the spiking model, and so you have direct correspondence between parameters. You just set them, you know, to have the same values.
But then, so it's not like you set your spiking model parameters. Like it was a sort of a.
You can do it either way. You can. Right. You can use your mean field model because you can do analysis on it. You understand it well. You know if you increase this parameter, then that's going to happen to the frequency, and you know oscillation is going to stop at that parameter. Then you can do the same thing in the spiking model because there is direct correspondence between the two.
Okay.
I think those were probably, if you use a finite domain, a square domain, then if you pick the critical wave, you'll be a bad